Hello, and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for June 5th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the economic stimulus package and returns on scientific investment, an essay from our year-long Origin series on the origin of sex, and how war and trade influence the evolution of modern human behavior. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about a billion-year hard drive from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The 2009 American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, or Economic Stimulus Package, included more than $21 billion in funding for U.S. science agencies, including the National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation. One science advocacy institute, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, estimated that the stimulus package would create or retain approximately 400,000 jobs for 1 year. But in a policy forum in this week's Science, Julia Lane says there's no consensus on how to calculate the return on investment for science funding, even though, she writes, science policy in the U.S. and abroad is largely predicated on the belief that the outcomes of scientific investments are both certain and tied to economic growth. That could present some challenges, Lane says, when the public wants an assessment of the impact of science stimulus. Lane is program director of the Science of Science and Innovation Policy Program at the National Science Foundation. I spoke with her from her office in Arlington, Virginia.
This is about trying to develop the scientific basis upon which science policy decisions are being made, and it tries to describe what the issues are and the possible contributions that social scientists and behavioral scientists can make.
What are some of the main issues regarding the science policy and the science of science policy?
Well, there are several issues. One is that we are trying to describe quite a massive enterprise, which goes from the individual scientist to having a discovery to the multiple pathways by which that discovery gets turned into innovation. And so there's a social environment to understand, there's the human dynamics of project teams, there's a political environment, and it varies by domain, by the discipline that you're trying to study. So it's an extremely complex ecology of innovation.
Is there any consensus on how to calculate the return on investment when the investment is in scientific research?
No.
Does that go for basic, translational, and applied scientific research?
Yes. In other words, there is no consensus. I think there's an evolving set of approaches, but it's still very much at the early stages. I imagine it's kind of at the stage, if you were a life scientist, we're kind of at the Charles Darwin stage.
Why invest in basic research in an economic recovery plan?
Well, it's the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, right? So I think the point that we're trying to make in the article is that the belief was that investing in science has a bigger impact than investing in a football stadium. And the real challenge, I think, for the science of science policy is trying to provide the empirical and theoretical foundations behind that claim.
So do you think then that in looking at return on investment, that money spent on science be split into two categories, one for basic research and one for translational or applied science?
So I think the literature's out on that one. We've got some principal investigators who really quibble about whether that's a meaningful distinction. So I think the jury's out.
Looking at the literature, I see there's a National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering and Institute of Medicine report that addressed the same topic of measuring and evaluating dollars spent on scientific research from 10 years ago.
Yes.
This is the Evaluating Federal Research Programs. Are you familiar with this report?
Yes.
Now, in that, the authors conclude that the useful outcomes of basic research can't be measured directly on an annual basis, and so must instead be measured by historical reviews on a much longer time frame. but that instead quality, relevance, and leadership, they say, are good predictors of eventual usefulness, and those are meaningful annual measures. Since then, have scientists learned something new, or are scientists expected to come to a different conclusion in this latest effort to assess the impact of science?
Again, you're asking very good questions. So if you take a look at the work that the Interagency Group on Science Policy put together, there's a roadmap that's on scienceofsciencepolicy.net.
And you helped chair that group.
I co-chaired that with my esteemed co-chair, Bill Valdez, from the Office of Science at the Department of Energy. And he's been thinking about these issues for much longer than I have. I'm just an economist who has been looking at these issues lately. He and the other federal agency representatives who were involved in the roadmap believe that there have been tremendous changes over the past 10 years, both in our understanding of the scientific enterprise and on the ability to access new and different types of data and the evolution of different types of metrics. And so I think the sense of the roadmap is that there is an emerging literature and a nascent body of community of practice that could push the frontier further than was possible 10 years ago. I should say that one of the critical elements that's going to be necessary for that is to build a data infrastructure that gives us a better sense of the relationship between scientific inputs, investments, and different types of outputs. And in particular, you know, moving the science agencies from a program administration data collection effort to a management information system. And I think that will help go a long way to moving our science forward.
Now, I saw in that program, that policy website that you mentioned, there were wikis and things like that. Is that designed to sort of tap the broader audience of scientists out there in order to maybe use crowdsourcing, as it were?
You got it. Yep, that's very much part of what we're about. Now, it turns out we are learning about how to do wikis. That wiki itself has not been very well utilized, so we are working with STPI, the Science and Technology Policy Institute, to develop a much better crowdsourcing, if you like, website so that it's properly a Web 2.0. So we get a dialogue between the research community and the federal practitioner community so that when you do get ideas that bubble up, the community as a whole can pile on and say, no, you got that wrong or you got that right. But, you know, in the notion of this new administration's openness and transparency, developing a dialogue between the federal and the research community.
Now, you state in your policy form that within 2 years, the public will want to be informed about the impact of the stimulus on the economic recovery. What kind of answers will you have for the public or the scientific public at that time?
Great question again. So, you know, I'm an economist. You don't expect any answers at all, ever, right? That's
okay.
A joke.
Yep, okay.
So, yeah, the public's going to expect answers, and I think there's a lot of money getting spent on science, and as you pointed out, there's a very real opportunity cost. When you invest in science, that means you're not investing in, let's say, healthcare for the poor or child education or something for the elderly or whatever. So there's a very real cost. So those are reasonable questions to be asked. I think we will have some ideas on how the impact of the stimulus has worked through the system. And one of the ways in which we're going to know that is that we have a call out for rapid funding for social scientists to come in and study not the impact of the stimulus per se, but try and get an understanding of how science investments work their way through the system and what kind of impact they have on multiple dimensions. And those are being funded on a flow basis now. If there are any scientists listening to this, please get in touch with me if you're interested in applying for that kind of funding. And we'll have a portfolio of research projects. The rapid proposals take 1 year to get through, and we'll start to have some sense of how that's worked through the system. So that'll be one part, but I also imagine that over the next few years, social scientists are going to be studying the impact of the stimulus in its own right, as well as just in response to the rapid call in SICEP.
And so there'll be some sort of report at that time, or?
We haven't thought through exactly how we're going to showcase the results of that call. There have been about 30 proposals submitted so far, and I hope that there'll be more. There may be probably 7, 8, 9 that are funded. I'd certainly like to showcase the results of that research in some form, but the way in which that showcased depends on, you know, how things come together next year.
Julia Lane, thank you very much.
Thank you indeed.
Julia Lane of the National Science Foundation is author of this week's policy forum on assessing the impact of science funding.
Sex is one of the biggest mysteries in life.
In our year-long series on evolution, Carl Zimmer has our latest installment, his essay on the origin of sex. I spoke with Zimmer from his home office in Connecticut.
You know, Darwin himself was really drawn to this mystery. So in 1862, he wrote, "We do not even in the least know the final cause of sexuality." And he wrote, "The whole subject is as yet hidden in darkness." And, you know, when a scientist comes across a problem like that, it's hard to resist. It's this thing that is incredibly common, but in fact, there's a real puzzle there. In some ways, sex shouldn't exist at all.
What do scientists hypothesize were the key evolutionary steps needed to go from asexual reproduction to sexual reproduction?
Well, fundamentally, from the point of view of evolution, there's a big cost to sex. Because if you take one asexual animal, for example, it will have some offspring, and those offspring will have offspring of their own. And they can just keep breeding like that, multiplying away, without any need for finding a mate. A sexual organism, on the other hand, it's got to find a mate, and then it's going to produce offspring. Probably half of them are going to be males, and half of them are going to be females, and only the females can reproduce. So you just cut your reproductive output in half, basically. So however sex evolved, it basically had to get over what's called this twofold cost of sex and keep being an advantage so that the asexual organisms didn't come back in and take over.
Are scientists in agreement about what that selective pressure might have been that makes sexual reproduction advantageous?
Well, what's interesting is that scientists are recognizing now that this isn't just one simple leap from no sex to being completely sexual. Like many major transitions in evolution, this took place probably over a series of steps. And so, in fact, the first step may have been just to evolve just one part of sexual reproduction. So one of the things that we have in common with other sexually reproducing species is that the sexual process sort of scrambles up our genes. So what happens is that as sperm and egg are being produced, each of those cells only has one copy of each chromosome, and the rest of our cells in our bodies have two copies. So which copy we pass down to our children can influence what kind of traits they have. Another thing that happens inside these cells is that these chromosomes kind of shuffle around with each other. So each pair of chromosomes sort of swaps pieces of DNA before they get split up and before your offspring inherit just one copy from each parent. So this process called meiosis probably happened in stages, according to some scientists that I write about in my piece. So you may have actually just had initially some single-celled eukaryotes that every now and then would duplicate their chromosomes, but they weren't having sex. They would just duplicate their chromosomes, they would line their chromosomes up and swap pieces of their DNA, and then they divide again so that they were back to having, you know, one chromosome apiece. So this would have been an initial step towards full-blown sex. You would eventually get to the point where you would have males and females, or, you know, in some species we just call them mating types, because, you know, mushrooms don't have males and females, but they do have different types that swap their genes. And so when you get into a system like that, you know, you have to ask, well, how did this kind of sexual reproduction become more and more common? There has to be something that favors it. And one surprising explanation that some scientists have had is that at first, maybe, the genes that encoded sexual reproduction actually were acting very selfishly. It's not that sex was better for organisms. It's not like it raised their fitness. It was just a way for these genes to get around better.
Sort of like a virus, it sounds like.
That's right. This harkens back to Richard Dawkins in his book, The Selfish Gene, where he was arguing that, you know, genes basically, in a sense, look out for themselves. genes that promote their own transmission are the ones that are going to be favored. So in some ways, yes, this is a bit like a virus. You have these genes that are spreading just because they are able to move around and also survive to not become extinct. So in one model, some scientists said, okay, let's see what happens if you create a model of organisms. Some of them are sexual, some of them are asexual, and they experience a crisis. They undergo a lot of stress every now and then. Because that's actually what happens today. There are some plants, for example, that will only have sex if there's a drought or some other crisis. And they found that these genes that would cause organisms to have sex will sort of naturally evolve so that what they do is during times of stress, they switch on and they cause organisms to have sex. And that actually lets them mix around and combine with other genes that will help to survive that crisis. But once a crisis is over, you don't want to break up those good genes. You've got this great combination of genes all together. And so these scientists found that actually then, once the crisis is over, these sexual genes would kind of shut down. So perhaps the first step to sexual reproduction was just sort of part-time sex. You would just have sex when there was a crisis that called for a really radical change.
But it sounds like there are a number of hypotheses still to be worked out on the origin of sex. Is there one that stands out from the others, or one that's building more consensus than the others?
Well, I'd say there are a few hypotheses that are gaining consensus. It used to be that people would argue in favor of one particular explanation for the evolution of sex and why sex continues to be so widespread. But a lot of scientists that I've spoken to say that it's more likely that there are a couple different forces at work and they're interacting with each other. It's not just one simple answer. That makes it harder to really test these hypotheses because they're all working together, but that's just the way that things are pointing. So, for example, if sex first evolved just as kind of an optional thing, you have to explain how sex became a mandatory thing for a lot of species like our own. And some researchers are now arguing that actually sexual selection made that happen. And sexual selection is basically when females, for example, find certain males more attractive than others. They look sexy, as it were. So it might be that, you know, a deer has big antlers or something like that. That could actually drive a population to be sexually reproducing all the time because those sexy individuals have so much success with sex and they're passing down their genes that they're going to just drive the whole population to just have sex. But then, you know, there are several other explanations that can help to explain, you know, why sex just keeps hanging on. And one scientist I talked to referred to them as the good, the bad, and the ugly.
You've got to say more about that.
So the good is basically the idea that sexual reproduction lets organisms combine good mutations together. So beneficial mutations pop up, and then, you know, males and females can combine their DNA and combine those beneficial mutations. Now, the bad refers to harmful mutations. So randomly, these harmful mutations will arise. And in a sexual reproducing population, these harmful mutations can get eliminated faster because they can be essentially broken up, separated from beneficial mutations. And then the ugly is an idea that parasites are responsible.
How so?
Well, parasites are a huge threat to the survival of lots of species. And they're going to be driving the evolution of their hosts, so that the hosts that have mutations that let them fight off these parasites are going to do much better than the ones who are vulnerable. So you can have really fast evolution of resistance to parasites. Problem is that the parasites are evolving too, and a lot of times they evolve faster than their hosts. So you're in this arms race, basically. And sexual organisms, they keep mixing their genes together, so it's not going to be so easy for the parasites to basically fix on them and evolve a way around their defenses. So parasites might give sexual organisms the edge.
And the good, the bad, the ugly, that's an example of one of these combinations of hypotheses you mentioned.
These ideas were all proposed and investigated separately in the past. But today, scientists are starting to look at them more and more in combination. So sex plus harmful mutations might be much more effective at keeping sex around than just parasites on their own or just harmful mutations on their own. And so now scientists are trying to combine these things to figure out how they can work together. It's very complicated, but it seems to be the way the science is going.
Carl Zimmer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer writes on the origin of sex in This Week's Science. You can find the whole series of Origin essays and a companion blog celebrating the year of Darwin at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Did warfare among ancestral hunter-gatherer groups affect the evolution of human social behaviors? In a paper in This Week's Science, Samuel Bowles reports that, yes, indeed, warfare could have favored the survival of hunter-gatherer groups containing altruistic individuals, therefore affecting the evolution of human social behavior. In another paper in This Week's Science, Adam Powell and colleagues report that changes in the size and structure of populations can explain why it was that, at various times tens of thousands of years ago, culturally inherited skills emerged and subsequently disappeared among various populations around the world. To help put these papers in perspective, I spoke with Ruth Mace, who reviews both papers in This Week's Science. Mace is an evolutionary anthropologist from the University of College London, and I spoke with her during her travels in California.
This perspective is reviewing two papers which address the issue of how human behavior and culture came to be the way it was. One specifically looking at the evolution of warlike behavior or any behavior that might help serve the group, which is costly to the individual, so altruistic or pro-social behavior really of any kind. And this paper is arguing that some form of genetic group level selection could promote that. The second paper is looking at the emergence of cultural modernity. So that's when modern humans started to paint, to make complex tools, all kinds of artifacts, probably all sorts of other behavioral differences that we don't necessarily know about, maybe to do with religions and things, who knows. But they're looking at cultural evolutionary models of what kind of conditions might have promoted the emergence of this kind of behavior. So they're both talking about events that happened, you know, in what's known as maybe the Upper Paleolithic or even earlier. And they're trying to make use of combining both kind of theoretical models of evolutionary processes and trying to use various ways of estimating data on what the demographic and other relevant parameters might have been.
So two papers, one on the effects of warlike behavior, the other on the emergence of cultural modernity. Let's start with the warlike behavior, the Bowles paper. In your perspective, you summarize the claim of the Bowles paper as the demographic structure of hunter-gatherer populations allowed group-selected genetic traits to evolve in humans. How so?
Well, what this paper is arguing is that humans lived in groups and that the available estimates from various hunter-gatherer studies of genetic variation show that the FST, which is a measure of the comparing the sort of within-group genetic variation with the between-group genetic variation. And it's argued that this demographic structure in these populations and these levels of FST are actually sufficient that it would be possible for some kind of altruistic behavior that promoted the survival of the group to evolve. And the particular behavior he's looking at is warfare, because that's clearly something that might be causing very, very costly losses. And if individuals can act as a group for the good of the group, then some groups will do better than other groups. So he's tried to assemble what data there is, both on mortality in warfare and on genetic variation between hunter-gatherer groups, and used them to test a model. And he's arguing that theoretically the level of mortality related to warfare and the degree of genetic differences between hunter-gatherer groups together are sufficient to cause slightly costly behavior, like being what he calls an altruistic warrior, to actually be favored through, even though it's slightly costly to the individual survival chances compared to, I guess, a selfish warrior, the benefits to the group enough to maintain that behavior. That's what he's arguing. So empirically, most people believe that selection at the level of the individual is much stronger, and that the genetic sort of differences between groups are generally not great enough. But, you know, he's done the math to work out how big these genetic differences would need to be for a given level of warfare mortality. And he's arguing that they might be big enough on the basis of some data that's been gathered from contemporary hunter-gatherer populations. So this paper's actually arguing that it would, in theory, be possible for this trait to be genetically determined, because he's arguing that the genetic differences are large enough between groups.
Let's turn now then to the emergence of cultural modernity and the Powell paper. In your perspective, you summarize the claim by Powell and colleagues as changes in population size and structure can explain the pattern of acquisition and loss of culturally inherited skills. And that's needing explanation, you write, because some aspects of behavioral modernity first appeared in southern Africa, possibly as early as 90,000 years ago, only to disappear again and reappear in Eurasia 45,000 years ago. The timing of these events makes a biological change in cognitive capacity a somewhat unlikely explanation. What's the evidence here that this disappearance and reemergence of culturally inherited skills tens of thousands of years ago isn't instead just gaps in the archaeological record for finding artifacts?
Well, I think that, you know, there may be a risk of that being the case, but I think it's quite widely believed that sort of anatomically modern humans, that's humans that physiologically looked like us and had brain size, you know, similar to our own, et cetera, et cetera, did emerge rather earlier than this kind of burst of cultural modernity with complex toolkits, art, you know, possibly religious and beliefs trading, all these kind of things are thought to have like popped up. You know, that's the kind of cultural modernization that they're talking about. And the question is, why did not all anatomically modern humans appear to have this behavior? And why did it emerge, you know, at different places around the world at different times? So why is there this kind of gap? And in some places, you know, there is a sort of suggestion that it emerged and then it was lost again and then it reemerged. And what they're arguing is that you need, they're building on an earlier model by Joe Henrich, which argued that you need, you know, a sufficient density, if you like, of sort of cultural parents for this cultural complexity to emerge and be maintained. And they are elaborating on that model and looking at the sort of group-structured population. And they argue that if you have either a high density of groups or enough migration between groups so that there's lots of cultural contact, then you can get the emergence of this cultural modernity. Whereas if you've got low population densities or lack of contact between groups, then there's going to be loss of cultural complexity. And therefore, rather than explaining some of these rises and falls in cultural complexity in terms of something like, you know, some kind of change in cognitive ability or something like that, changes in demography would be sufficient. So they're arguing that the historical changes in population density are enough to explain this pattern of, you know, emergence and loss of this phenomenon.
So the Powell paper is then, like the Bowles paper, equivocal. These two things could be happening at the same time, and there might be other things going on too.
Well, I think there have been a sort of, yes, I mean, there are a range, various explanations have been put forward. But what both papers do is they do try and look for, you know, data that can inform these models, because, you know, the models alone maybe can't do a great job of convincing people. And in the case of the Powell paper, what they've done is they've actually looked at genetic variation around the world and used coalescent models to try and estimate historical population densities in parts of the world. So they argue that there is some evidence that the population density increased at just around the same time that they observed this change in cultural behavior. So again, they're bringing to bear, you know, as with the other paper, they're not just putting forward the model, they're trying to bring forward some empirical evidence that supports it. as I said in the perspective, I mean, in the case of the Powell paper, it acts as a bit of a caution for, you know, someone might be tempted, for example, to look for a candidate gene that could possibly explain why some groups of humans suddenly became much more culturally complex than others. And what they're actually showing is that if you were to do that, you know, just sort of correlating cultural complexity with the geographic pattern, for example, of some kind of gene allele would really not necessarily be a very reliable thing to do, because what they're arguing is that changes in population density alone or changes in, you know, migratory contact between groups alone could be enough to spur these changes. So the case for, you know, looking for some kind of genetic or other anatomical or physiological reason why humans were behaving differently in some populations from others is more complicated than people thought.
Ruth Mace, thank you very much.
Okay.
Ruth Mace of University College London on how war and trade influenced the evolution of modern human behavior. The two papers Mace discusses in her perspective are by Adam Powell and colleagues, titled Late Pleistocene Demography and the Appearance of Modern Human Behavior, and by Samuel Bowles, titled Did Warfare Among Ancestral Hunter-Gatherers Affect the Evolution of Human Social Behaviors? Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. First up, a billion-year hard drive. What would make it last a billion years, Dave?
Well, Rob, it all has to do with nanotechnology. Researchers took these single iron crystals and they put them into these hollow carbon nanotubes. And nanotubes, just like diamonds, nanotubes are among the most stable structures in existence. So we're talking about something that's very permanent, very durable here, and hence the term billion-year hard drive. And how it would work is like this. You know, Rob, that computers read binary, and that means the computers read a series of ones and zeros. And how that translates into this setup is these little iron crystals can move from one end of the nanotube to the other. So if they're at one end, it's, say, a one, and if they're at the other end, it's a zero. And the researchers can use an electrical force to make this happen. And actually, you can see a video of these little iron crystals moving back and forth within the nanotubes on the site.
Are we just talking about a prototype here, or is there a likelihood that this will ever make it to market?
Well, you know, this seems like a really complicated process. And, you know, the question is, well, why go through all this trouble in the first place? And it turns out there really may be a market for this stuff because our current storage technology is actually not very good. In fact, as we become more technologically advanced as a civilization, our ability to store information has gotten a lot worse, which is kind of ironic.
How so?
Well, take this example. In the year 1085, William the Conqueror compiled what's called the Domesday Book, which was a record of English settlements in the period. That book, 1,000 years later, is still around. But a DVD that you burned 5 years ago may not work anymore. DVDs are put together with glue and other materials that can actually come apart over time. It's something called DVD rot. And even when we're talking about hard drives or other types of storage, these other technologies rely on things like magnets, which can degrade over time. And so we really have this problem right now with data storage. We think we've got this great digital technology, but in fact, we've got a real problem with preserving a lot of the digital content we're creating right now. So a new technology like this, where you're not relying on magnetic media, where you're not relying on glue and other fragile materials, could potentially last for, the researchers say, millions, if not a billion years.
But it'll still be at least a few years before we're picking this up at the local electronics store?
Yeah, this is still a long way from commercial development.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you today?
Well, Rob, how about a story about poop?
Sure, tell me more.
Well, Rob, this story is all about tracking penguins in the Antarctic.
By their poop?
Exactly. And in this case, we're actually talking about emperor penguins, which are really tall. They can grow to 1.2 meters tall. And you would think they're really not that hard to spot when you've got all this white ice that they live on. But it turns out they're actually really hard to find. First of all, the white and the black of these penguins blends in with the white of the ice and the black shadows on the ice. So it makes them really hard to spot from aerial photos or even from space when we're talking about satellite photography. And also, these penguins tend to really be out there and breeding in the very dark and cold months of the Antarctic winter. And researchers aren't around then. It's just too cold to be outside. So a lot of the evidence we have for how many emperor penguin colonies are in the Antarctic and just how many individuals there are is really sort of anecdotal. I mean, people on tour groups will see these penguins and scientists will sometimes run across them accidentally. But there really hasn't been any great way to quantify how many penguins and how many colonies are there.
So they're flying over Antarctica and taking pictures and looking for poop?
Well, that's what these researchers hit upon. They said, well, we can't deal with black and white, but how about reddish-brown stains, as in the reddish-brown guano of penguin poop? You would think that that would stand out a lot better on the Antarctic ice than the penguins would. But it's not that they're flying over the ice and looking for these poop stains, as it were. They're actually using satellite photography. And in this study, the researchers looked at a compilation of hundreds of photos of various regions of Antarctica.
Images taken by the satellite to look for poop stains?
Well, that wasn't the original purpose of these images. They're actually part of a project called the Landsat Image Mosaic of Antarctica that was done for other scientific reasons. But what these researchers found is when they peruse these photos, and they actually developed some software that would help pick up these reddish-brown stains, they were able to isolate particular penguin colonies just by finding their poop on the ice. And the study didn't end there. The researchers actually got some really interesting information out of this new methodology. First of all, they discovered 10 new colonies of emperor penguins that nobody knew about before. And they also discovered that 6 colonies that people did know about seemed to have disappeared. And it turns out these colonies were in places far north in Antarctica. And the researchers think that climate change may have actually caused them to disappear.
Or perhaps move to a different spot, and so might be one of these 10 previously unknown colonies.
I suppose that's possible.
Okay, last story. What's this one about?
Well, Rob, how about one more animal story? This one is about monkeys, specifically tufted capuchin monkeys that live in South America. And these are really small monkeys. They live in groups of about 7 to 40 individuals, and they have this very hierarchical society where members that have very high status tend to bully members with lower status and take their food and, you know, have other bullying behaviors. And it turns out that these lower status monkeys may have found a way to even the score.
Now, you've got a sound file with you, I see. Is that a capuchin monkey evening the score somehow?
This is how they even the score. And listen to this file.
What was that?
Well, believe it or not, that is a capuchin monkey warning call. This is the sound they make when there's a predator nearby, say a snake or a predator cat like an ocelot. And typically the monkeys use these calls to let everybody know, hey, there's a predator nearby, let's all get out of here. But what one researcher observed was that sometimes monkeys, especially these lower class monkeys, would make these calls when there were no predators around at all, but when all the other monkeys were feeding. And what happened, what he noticed was that when these lower class monkeys would make this call, a lot of the other monkeys, especially the higher class monkeys, would scram because they thought a predator was nearby. And all of a sudden, there was all this food that they were eating left behind. And he said, I wonder if these lower class monkeys are faking these alarm calls. And it turns out it looks like they do. He conducted a series of experiments and he found that when these lower class monkeys make the alarm call, the higher class monkeys would leave. And when they did so, the lower class monkeys would swoop in and steal, you know, say their banana or whatever else they were eating.
How often did that work? I mean, this seems to sound as if there's some deception going on, or is there some other reason why they would be making the calls?
Well, that's really one of the central questions posed by this study, because if it turns out that the monkeys are actually doing this on purpose, if they're being deceptive, if they're crying wolf, as it were, it indicates a very advanced cognitive ability. It indicates that the monkeys have evolved the ability to predict how others in their group will respond to certain stimuli. And it feeds into this larger concept called Machiavellian intelligence. And the idea here is that societies have evolved this ability where individuals have learned to be deceptive to better compete. And in this case, the monkeys are trying to compete by evening the score. But it's still an open question about whether the monkeys are actually doing this on purpose. And it's important to note here that these fake calls only worked about 40% of the time. And one expert points out that perhaps the monkeys are just making the calls because they get nervous around higher ranking monkeys and they're just stressed out and they're making these calls. And the effect of these higher ranking monkeys running away and the other monkeys getting the banana is just a nice side bonus, but that the monkeys actually aren't doing it to be deceptive. And that's really an open question at this point. And again, is really going to be important for deciding how smart these monkeys really are.
Oops, I didn't mean for you to run away, Dave.
I'm still here, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about the evolution of laughter. So that should be a really fun one. And on the Science Policy blog, we continue to follow swine flu. We've got almost daily updates on what's going on with the latest with this pandemic. And also a new report out about how women are faring in academia. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the Science Policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the June 5th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.